It's 12:45. We have a quorum in the room. We've got 9 folks. Where'd they go? No, we had. We've got 8.
Recess to the call of the chair.
He checked in.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he'll be back.
Okay.
Yeah. You can always move him after.
Okay, we will skip reading the minutes right now and hear from the Pollution Control Agency.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Greta Gauthier, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm here today to do an overview of our agency for the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to do this, and we're looking forward to being able to tell you more about what we do. So with that, I'll just get started. So our mission is to protect and improve the environment and enhance human health. And we do this in a number of ways, but we kind of think of our core services or products are around figuring out what's going on in the environment through monitoring of land, air, and water. We issue permits, and when necessary, we enforce regulations. We also educate and work on compliance to prevent pollution. And we also, under our authority from some federal and state laws, we find and clean up contaminated sites. We also respond to emergencies and spills, and we also work on rulemaking and policies affecting the environment. By the numbers, Madam Chair, we have about 18,000 permits out there at any one time that limit pollution and protect public health. We have about 2,300 monitoring sites across the state for air, land, and groundwater. And we are inspecting about 40,000 sites related to hazardous waste, storage, and feedlots. And we have 29 programs. A little bit of history and about our authority. So there are 229 state laws that apply to the MPCA and our program operations. So we have a lot of statutory statutory items that we carry out. We are also a delegated agency. So agencies that are delegated from the federal government, we sign an agreement with, for example, in our case, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And under that delegation agreement, we carry out federal law, implement it, and enforce it in Minnesota. So Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, et cetera. So our delegations are listed there. We have air program delegations, water, and land. And all of those programs, all of those delegations agreements are renewed periodically. And many of them require that we have rules on the books in Minnesota that conform to federal requirements. I wanted to show this picture here because it's a good historical picture and a great story about the olden days. So this is from back in the 1960s, which is not that old to some of us in the room. But what the picture is there is a pile of dead ducks. And this happened as the result, of an industrial accident, a couple of them actually, on the Minnesota and the Mississippi River back at the end of 1962 and the beginning of 1963. So the first one in December of 62 was a ruptured oil pipe that put 1 million gallons of petroleum into the Minnesota River. And the second one was a storage tank collapse in Mankato that put 2.5 million gallons of soybean oil into the Minnesota River. And what happened was there was a coating on the river from St. Paul all the way down to Lake Pepin, and there was a big impact on waterfowl. And this gentleman standing there without the hat on, he worked at a stockyard down in St. Paul, and he and others were very upset about the wildlife loss and what was happening, and he brought two big bushelfuls of these dead animals and dumped them in the Capitol Rotunda. And he got people's attention that way. At the time this happened, there was no agency to respond to it. There was no regulatory structure. And so that and other things like it happening in the 1960s were one of the things that led to the formation of our organization. And our agency has been around since 1967. So we actually were in place before the federal government created the US EPA by a few years. So who do we work with? We have a very strong cultural and managerial priority of working with partners wherever we can. We work with businesses. We work with all levels of government. We work with tribal nations, non-governmental organizations. We have a network of about 1,200 at any one time citizen water monitors across the state, citizens who volunteer their time to monitor water near where they live or recreate. And, of course, we partner with Minnesota residents. The two pictures here, the one at the top is the Sappy's North America's paper mill in Cloquet, which got the Minnesota Governor's Award for Excellence in Waste and Pollution Prevention in 2009. And down on the bottom there, those are some of our citizen monitors collecting water samples. From an organizational standpoint, we have an office in St. Paul where about 70% of our employees are located. And the rest of our employees are in our six regional offices that you can see here. We have one office per region except for the Southeast region, which is in pink. We have two offices there, Mankato and Rochester, primarily because one of our programs is feedlot, taking care of feedlots, and there's a lot of feedlots down in that area. So we our offices are throughout the state and hopefully fairly convenient for folks to visit. We often co-office with other state agencies. So, as I said, we were established in 1967. We're considered a medium-sized agency, nowhere as big as some of our bigger sisters, but bigger than some. We have about 900 FTEs. At any given time, we do bring on a lot of people in the summer, primarily college students who help us with monitoring, water monitoring. We have a very low turnover rate, about 2.5%. We take polls periodically of our staff, and they say they are very satisfied working for our agency, and they are very mission-driven. About 48% of our staff are women, and 70% of our staff are scientists, various professional backgrounds, a lot of engineers and hydrologists and chemists, some soil scientists and biologists too, and of course environmental scientists. So I'll talk a little bit more about our organizational structure. We have these divisions. So our commissioner's office is over the top, and then we have these seven divisions. And I'll go into each of them a little bit. But just at the outset, you'll notice that a couple of them are focused on customers, industrial and municipal, over on the right-hand side of the slide. And then others are focused on our scientific background and data analysis and so forth. And then we also have one focused on another kind of customer unit, if you will, which is watersheds. A high-level picture of, you know, where, how do we get our funding and where does it come from? So the largest piece of the pie here is the Environmental Fund. And the Environmental Fund is funded through several different ways, mainly the solid waste tax that goes on garbage, the trash that you and I throw out and is hauled to landfills or processing centers. We also, part of the Environmental Fund goes into the Remediation Fund, which is used for cleanups. We also get some federal funds. And you'll see there we get Clean Water Fund. We have a small amount of general fund. We really don't have a lot of general fund funding our agency. A little bit from the Clean Water Revolving Loan Program and program through the federal government and PFA for clean water projects. And we have a tiny piece there from the closed landfill investment fund, which I believe reflects what we will be doing at the second half of this biennium when those funds become available. And, oops, hang on a second. And where the money goes. So a big portion of our funding goes to watersheds and to remediation. Those are kind of our core functions, again. Remediation are the cleanups, Superfund, and that sort of program. Watersheds are our work to do things called total maximum daily load and figuring out what's going into different bodies in a watershed, and then working with local communities there to figure out how they want to manage that water. And our resource management and assistance provides a lot of technical assistance to cities and other groups, businesses, small businesses. We have a small business environmental loan program that we operate, and that's to help small businesses when they have to comply with regulations and they need new equipment or other new adjustments to their shop in order to do that. Our municipal and industrial divisions are there, and then our environmental analysis and outcomes at the top, that is where we do a lot of our data analysis. We do our, that's the work on our water quality standards and so forth, air quality standards, et cetera. So division by division, a little bit more. Remediation is about 18% of our budget. Cleaning up contaminated properties, including landfills, managing long-term projects, like the PFAS contamination in groundwater in the East Metro that the 3M settlement addressed last year, for those of you who were here. The closed landfill program. So the legislature back in the 1990s, some of these landfills started closing, and they were a litigation nightmare because it was trying to close them under the Superfund Act, which is a federal and state law that requires we find responsible parties and that those parties pay for the cleanup. Well, people just kept suing people and suing people. So the legislature stepped in and created the closed landfill program. Closed landfill program, the owner of the landfill enters the program. The landfill becomes, the care and maintenance of the landfill becomes the state's responsibility in perpetuity, but there are no more lawsuits. And that has been very effective. We have 114 landfills that are eligible for that program, and 110 of them have enrolled. So within the next period of time here, those last four or so will finish up and enter the program too, we anticipate. But that's what folks in remediation do. Another hot issue they've been working on recently is vapor intrusion, which is going back to some of our cleaned up sites already, because we've now learned that sometimes the contamination, even though it was cleaned up in the past, tiny pieces of vapor molecules actually are in the soil, and they slowly evaporate upward. And if there's a crack in the foundation of a home or an office or a building, it can seep in and impact the indoor air quality. So the legislature's given us money in the past 5 or 6 years to go back and start and keep looking at those sites, because we can. It's an easy fix for people's homes. We just put a venting system in to take that, pull it sub slab and up and out the top of the house. And once the air molecules disperse, they are no longer at toxic or at harmful levels. So those are some of the highlights of what is happening in remediation right now. Our watershed division is about 16% of our budget. And here's some of the high-level things that we do here. We look for solutions for water pollution problems. We do issue permits for animal feedlots. We manage several grant programs that benefit a lot of our local partners. Pardon me. And again, this is where our watershed division is, where our local water monitors are, and where our college students in the summer come and assist with some of this monitoring work. Our operations division, this includes the commissioner's office, is 18% of our budget. And this is, of course, like operations divisions in most organizations, fiscal, contracting, human services, legal, human resources, communication, data management, fleet, facilities, and then, of course, our emergency management also. Our environmental analysis and outcomes division is about 12% of our budget. And this one is, this division works on monitoring and evaluating environmental conditions and developing environmental standards and really making environmental data available broadly to stakeholders and the public. So a little known fact about our agency that some of you may have heard, but for the new members, we get more data requests than almost any state agency. We get about 400 or more per month of data requests for various types of environmental data, files, background information. A lot of that is from environmental consultants and cleanup companies, but still, that's a big function we have of turning that information around quickly so that folks who need it can get on with whatever project that they're trying to do. Our resource management and assistance division is about a fifth of our budget. And this unit is, as I said, provides technical assistance, works to address pollution through preventive measures. We always say there's three ways you can manage pollution. You can prevent it, you can manage it, or you can clean it up. And cleaning it up is always the most expensive, and preventing it is always the cheapest. So these folks are working on prevention, working with communities and other organizations to figure out ways to prevent, providing technical and financial assistance, educational services. And then they also house our solid waste, hazardous waste, rulemaking program, and storage tanks program. We regulate underground storage tanks. And that is a federal delegation as well. Our industrial division is about 8%, and their key work is working with the private industrial facilities on permitting, compliance, and enforcement. So they encompass all types of regulations, so air quality, water quality, haz waste, and tanks, but they will work with each permittee on multiple permits and make sure that there is compliance and that the that we are working as efficiently and effectively as we can. Our municipal division is about 7% of our budget. Functions a lot like our industrial division, except works with cities. So we regulate all the city sewage treatment plants in Minnesota. And there's about 620-some of those across the state. About half of them are mechanical facilities, and about half of them are pond systems, where there's a settling out process. And those are generally the smaller ones. So these folks work with cities and towns to ensure proper management, not only of the wastewater facilities, but stormwater systems and also septic systems. We regulate subsurface sewage systems or septics as well. So technical assistance, permitting, compliance, enforcement, and development of policy are some of the things the municipal folks do. We do have a municipal liaison who works directly with cities and helps them through whatever process they're going through, whether it's needing technical assistance or permitting, understanding how something is working and how what they need to do to comply. And we also have a business ombudsperson, too, who works with businesses in a similar way. So although our organization has these divisions, we are a matrix organization like most organizations these days. So we do have a lot of cross divisional teams. One of the group of cross divisional teams is this one here with air, water, land, and operations. So the senior leaders, for example, of any program dealing with air, they get together and meet monthly and talk about issues of common interest, problems, questions, trying to streamline processes and so forth. And it's a great bridge between divisions and to help people from different perspectives come at a problem from different angles and find better solutions. So we have a group for air and water and land and one for operations. So that's one layer of a matrix. And then another one are our management teams. So these are teams focused around managing the agency. So as you can see, we have seven of those as well, and they also span several of the divisions. So continuous improvement is a big one. We are very focused on continuous improvement, have a lot of projects, and we'll have a handout ready for you when we do our budget presentation. Of course, emergency preparedness, environmental results, external engagement, fiscal systems, human resources, and info systems. So again, people working on these in these areas from across divisions come together to solve problems and figure out ways we can work better. And here's one of the last layers is some of our lateral kind of teams too. We have one for enforcement, one for permit managers, and one for regulatory action. So for example, our enforcement decisions, like a decision on a penalty, those are always made by a group of people, never by one inspector or one person, one permit writer, one individual. It's always coming out of a group discussion and process about what is appropriate for this situation and so forth. Part of the overview, I think I would be remiss if we didn't talk about some of the trade-offs and tandems that we work with on a daily basis. So, for example, there's a couple of key trade-offs that we are juggling all the time. One is the trade-off between timeliness and due diligence. So we always want to make decisions as expeditiously as possible, but we do have a responsibility under the law to ensure that all the relevant information is reviewed and confirmed and taken into account. So there's constantly a trade-off there that we work on. And similarly, there's a trade-off between public engagement and efficiency. It's very important that Minnesotans have a say in the decisions that affect the environment in our state. And the reality, though, of engagement processes is that they take time. And it takes time to reach out and hear from people and understand what they think. So that bumps up against the goal of efficiency sometimes. And so that's why I think we have in statute a lot of the requirements in the Administrative Procedures Act for us to do public notice and public comment periods and public meetings and so forth. But there's always a tension there as well. And then there's a couple of tandems or things that we kind of have to balance. And one of those is risk and uncertainty. So we can quantify risk on a lot of things now. Not always, but our technology can quantify the risk, but our current level of technology can't make the risk go away. It's always going to be there. So then it becomes a question of what is the uncertainty associated with that risk and what level of uncertainty and what level of risk is acceptable for this given. It often ends up being project specific. So, you know, people have different comfort levels with different things, and that's all part of the public input, which again comes back to why the law sets up a very deliberative process that engages people. Because these tensions are always there. And then probably the biggest, you know, partnership or tandem there is environment and economy, and they really go hand in hand. But it really is more than a direct conflict or a direct two distinct things. It's not really the environment and the economy. It's more about the timing and the timeliness because oftentimes, the economy side of this is a project that's going to be built now. So the economic impact is very clear and tangible. But the environmental impact of something sometimes is going to be in the long term. It's not going to be clear or tangible for a long time. And so it ends up being about the present versus the future. And our goal is to make sure that businesses and people who want to have projects and build things in the present do so in a way that people in the future can have their businesses and their farms and their projects and their houses and so forth. So it's kind of a trade-off or a consideration at the same time of the current and the future. And so that's something else that kind of underpins everything that we think about when we're making decisions. So I just wanted to bring those up because they are kind of always present and not always uniform in how people define them. then I would say another thing that is impacting our agency a lot these days are some of the 21st century issues, including the fact that environmental and human health is evolving and evolving rapidly in some cases, very rapidly. And so how that impacts us, for example, is what has happened in the East Metro, where we had a certain environmental limit or health risk limit, excuse me, for PFAS. And then a lot of research was done, and the health risk limit got ratcheted down because it was learned that they were more impactful of human health than had been thought. Then we had to go back. Now that there's a lower limit, we have to test a bunch of other private wells to make sure that we're offering people the filtration systems that they need if they have contamination levels that are above the health limit. So in that regard, human health science is impacting our work. Also, the technology for detecting things in the water and in the air has advanced a lot more rapidly than technology for cleaning up. So we find ourselves in the position sometimes where we can detect a problem and we know it's there, but we don't have as many options for cleaning it up or getting rid of it or however we dealing with it, because the technologies are just moving at different paces. And then there's always a kind of what we can measure versus what we can manage. So, you know, the fast advancement of science in measurement and management is kind of both, but it means we can measure a lot more. But sometimes we don't have the scientific data we need to know how to manage that level. So along with what I just talked about being the technology that we don't have for cleanup, we also don't sometimes have the scientific data we need for the precise measurements that we would like to see. So these are things that are happening a lot related to technology and the rapid advancement of that in the current day and age. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions, and we will go into more detail when we have our budget hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two different, one observation and then some questions. When you did the remediation fund and said, or the environmental fund, and said that solid waste tax put a lot of money in there. Well, the solid waste tax was originally meant to deal with solid waste. So it would be helpful to know how much, and we don't have to know it now, but if you could bring us a new pie chart that had how much of that fund is actually from the solid waste tax, and then how much of the solid waste tax that goes into your agency is spent on solid waste. It would be helpful.
Ms. Guthrie.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, yes, we can get that for you.
Okay.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. On your page 6, you talked about, or you mentioned, and I'm glad to hear this, that prevention is always the cheapest. Mm-hmm. And so I am thinking about a study your agency did, or you were doing some random sampling of pharmaceuticals in our water. And you found one of the hot spots was in the Crow River as it came into the Mississippi. And that, of course, is about 20 miles above the drinking water intakes for Minneapolis and St. Paul and the suburbs that use the Minneapolis and St. Paul systems. Mm-hmm. So given that prevention is always the cheapest, what are your plans for the pharmaceuticals that are now getting into our surface waters and obviously getting into our drinking water systems?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, thank you for that question. I'm going to have one of the other assistant commissioners come up and help me on this one.
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name for the record is Kirk Kadelka. I'm an assistant commissioner, work on land policy issues. And I think the first part of that is when folks dispose of pharmaceuticals and medicines. And we have been working with the Board of Pharmacy and other partners and having a collection program throughout the state. We have looked at the metrics, and we can provide them more, but within 10 miles of any resident, 90% of Minnesotans live within 10 miles of a disposal point for pharmaceutical drugs. The thing is, no one knows that. I mean, that's one of the things we need to continue to work on. We have that education in terms of our website, and these are usually, a lot of times it starts out with Sheriff's Office. Chisago County was one of the first to do that. They provided that service, a drop-off box there, and a lot of sheriff's offices moved forward through that in addition. It's now greatly expanded to local police departments, but where we're really seeing the last couple of years, because of a law change by the legislature that helped allow for pharmacies to take back and have drop-off boxes, and we are now seeing a lot more locations across the entire state as a result of that, where you can bring back pharmaceuticals and medicines to a pharmacy. We're getting to the point where it may also now be a competitive advantage for a pharmacy to have one of these drop-off sites. So we're getting better on that. There's also other technologies. There's mailback programs. There's pouches that people can put their medicines in. They don't have to worry about, you know, mixing it together and have a chemistry project on their table with a bag and that, and then mail it back. It's the same system that the U.S. Postal Service has used to send medicines to one's home. Can be then brought to incineration to take care of. This is trying to keep it out of landfills, wastewater systems, septic systems. So that, to your question of prevention, what are we doing? Those are the efforts. We're trying to continue to expand that and work on education to it. We do know local units of government, especially counties and sheriff's offices, that is an ongoing operation and maintenance cost for them, that they have concerns, and it's a heartache for them because of those additional dollars. We have grant programs right now that we have drop-off sites that we're trying to get folks to sign up for, but it's that ongoing operation and maintenance that makes some entities hesitant because of that ongoing fiscal cost.
Representative Guinness.
You talked about the smaller portion, the portion that is not used, but the larger portion by far is the portion that is used by people or by animals. So what are you doing with that portion that is actually getting into our into, say, the Mississippi, for example?
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Shannon Lotthammer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy at the Pollution Control Agency. And some of the things that we're doing along those lines is really working with the University of Minnesota, for example, their civil engineering program. They have a very robust research program to look at what are some of the treatment technologies that are being developed. First, what existing treatment technologies, how they perform in removing pharmaceuticals and other contaminants of concern, and then what might be some new technologies going forward that might provide the ability to address that as well. You know, we're not at the point right now where there's enough scientific data and studies to be able to set water quality standards based on a lot of these pollutants, because all of that underlying research still hasn't been fully developed. But we are looking at the industry to see where there might be opportunities as, you know, facilities come up for reconstruction, things like that, into the future, to start thinking about what might be those technology opportunities. So very supportive of that work that's happening at the university. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that this isn't so much for pharmaceuticals, but for other types of chemicals that can get into the waste stream. We do have an effort to work with manufacturers and also work across the U.S. on safer chemistries. It's a small effort, but because there's a lot that's happening actually in the industry and that we can kind of capitalize on with other states that are working on this as well, but through things like the Toxics in Children's Products and then also the Safer Chemistries efforts, really looking for what are other types of chemical formulas that can provide that same consumer benefit, but at a lower risk to the environment or to human health once that gets through the waste stream. And looking to pilot, we also have some environmental assistance grants that can be used when those chemistries are identified to actually pilot turning those into products then and getting that into the commercial system as a replacement to some of the more problem chemicals that are identified.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. Let's go back to the pharmaceuticals going through the wastewater treatment system or through septic systems. What is your benchmark for having standards that actually are protective of our waters.
Ms. Lothammer.
So, Mr. Chair and members, that's actually one of the challenges right now is, I mean, we have the guidance from the Environmental Protection Agency and in state law and rules about, you know, what are the protective levels, and I'd have to go back and look at those numbers as far as what the specific health risk numbers are. But we don't have all of the underlying science yet that can tell you, is this particular level of a chemical in at too high of a risk compared to those risk benchmarks. So we do have those benchmarks, but as far as the data to be able to compare them against, that research is still ongoing.
Representative Wiggins.
Here. But that research could be going on for 100 years or it could be going on for 2 years. So what is the timeline when, I mean, it's my constituents' drinking water, and that's why I'm bringing this up. What's your timeline for doing some more? And the other thing, there are 202 wastewater treatment systems in the Upper Mississippi Basin, which is the basin where our drinking water comes from. So I don't feel an urgency here. I feel an urgency, and I suspect my constituents feel an urgency. What's your timeline for actually getting something done here?
Mr. Chair and members, so our timeline is as that data becomes available, as that research becomes available, to be able to then use that underlying research scientist to turn that into water quality standards and other tools. I'd be remiss, though, if I didn't point out that there is work being done by other agencies as well. The Minnesota Department of Health has a very robust program looking at contaminants of emerging concern, where the data aren't at the level where they can establish water quality, where we can use it to establish water quality standards in some cases, but they're developing benchmarks that then we can use to help identify what might be some of the contaminants that we need to prioritize, whether it's looking out at the research community to see what's available, talking with researchers about what the need is from a data standpoint, and also looking on the prevention side. So where could we target more efforts in prevention? Because we don't need a standard to work upstream and say, hey, this is a contaminant that's showing up. Let's figure out how to get it out of the system. So I recognize the frustration about the timing. We don't have full control over that, but we also are working really diligently to incorporate the information that is available.
Representative Wiggins.
Well, I think it would be helpful for us to see a list of likely contaminants, because some of them are pretty likely, mm-hmm. and what a timeline would be for some of the most likely and some of the most solvable. This has been going on for a long time.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Wiggins, we can do our best to pull that kind of information together.
Can I?
Representative Wiggins.
Okay, so when we were at the, I'll switch again to another prevention. It's cheaper than remediation. And when we were at the DNR roundtable, and you and I were in the same group, somebody from, I think, Cedar Creek talked about the land application of biosolids, I mean, coming from wastewater treatment systems, so they're human waste. And the question was, is it getting into the creek? One. And then the second question, there seemed to be an assumption from the citizens that that was the case. What are your standards? Or let me put it a different way. When's the last time you updated the standards for the solids that are going on to, given that science is moving really quickly in endocrine disruptors and there's a ton of science out there?
Ms. Lothammer.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Wiggins, we do have a very robust biosolids program that requires, it's part of the permitting program, it requires testing, there's specific things that are tested for, and there's also setback requirements and things like that. I think probably the best way to respond, though, would be for us to follow up with that information, because I don't have the details with me.
Representative Wiggins.
Well, I did look at the chemicals you're testing, and there are things that we've known about for years, like lead, arsenic, and those, so the heavy metals. But the newer things, like the PFOAs and the PFOSs, which you have standards for other things, I didn't see on the list. So those would be the kinds of endocrine disruptors that get in the water. Our little boy fish become little girl fish. We know that. We already know that. So it would be good to see what those chemicals are and when you are going to have an updated list of standards for applying human waste to the land.
Ms. Lighthammer.
Mr. Chair, we can certainly pull together that information and share what we have, for sure.
Representative Backer.
Thank you. And I don't know if it goes with you two or Greta there, but last year we had just where MPCA is with the fugitive emissions with the ethanol plants and so forth. Do you have an update on that? Because I seem to be getting feedback from that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Backer, sorry, we're looking at each other. We don't have that specific information, but we have it back at the office, so we can certainly respond to that question. We do have, I know our industrial division has convened a group of ethanol facilities, and they've been working over the last 2 years to work through a number of questions and responses to that. So what we could absolutely do is provide the committee with a summary of what have been the issues that have been discussed, particularly the fugitive emissions questions and concerns. We know that that's been a topic that folks are very interested in. But I think we're just not equipped with the specifics in order to be very responsive to your question.
Chair Backer.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate that. That is something, would appreciate that follow-up because it is, I get calls on it because people cannot unload their stuff and they're frustrated because they're wasting fuel sitting in the line. So I would appreciate that. Loop me in on that. And then I have a second question. Is there any update in regards from the MPC for the large dairies that we are seeing throughout greater Minnesota? How's that working relationship working with the large dairies that we have out in greater Minnesota?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative, I can speak generally to that. We have, I would say, a strong, positive working relationship with those facilities. We've done a number of tours with those particular facilities and have many of them are doing some pretty innovative things when it comes to additional manure management activities, things like that, in order to be very protective of water quality. So if you have questions about a specific facility, we can certainly follow up on that, but it's definitely an area that we have staff that actively work with those feedlots and also with those county feedlot facility or county feedlot officers with dairies and other animal agricultural operations.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to follow up on the dairy stuff, when you have a feedlot that has less than 1,000 animal units, why are they still under the water permit program when they're not allowed to discharge?
Ms. Lighthammer.
Mr. Chair, that's a detail of the and Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, that's a detail of the feedlot program that I would need to follow up on. I don't have the specific answer with me today.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a number of things I'd like to talk about if possible. We've heard a lot of, it's been in the media a lot recently since session started with regards to true shrimp and conductivity. Can you give me an update on where we are? Governor Walz has been fairly outspoken on that.
So, Mr. Chair and Representatives, we have been working very closely with the City of Laverne. In the case of the True Shrimp facility, they weren't applying and they weren't looking for a permit from the Pollution Control Agency. What they were looking and still, I believe, are looking to do is to actually construct their facility and then send any wastewater that is remaining after they do some treatment on site to the City of Laverne's wastewater treatment facility. In order to accommodate that additional wastewater, as well as some additional economic growth within the city is in need of an upgrade to their wastewater treatment facility. They applied for a permit for that upgrade in September of 2018. We've been working with them on that permit process. They are looking at a construction schedule and had been back in September as well of constructing the facility or the upgrades next summer, and we are working diligently to meet that schedule, and we feel confident that, we will be reissuing that permit in time to meet their construction schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of the things that arose out of that was the letter that former Commissioner Linkstein sent to the mayor, talked about 21 months they've been working with him. Representative Backer just asked a question about fugitive dust and so forth, and you said that there's been, you know, work going on for 2 years with some of these things. You know, I think that's probably one of the greatest senses of frustration that I hear from county and city officials and business and so forth is that just the tremendous amount of time it takes to get something going through the agency. What kind of things can we look forward to in the next 2 to 4 years with regards to more what I would consider to be timeliness?
Ms. Lanhammer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, so, you know, you've heard us present in the past about our timeliness goals and how we meet and don't meet those timeliness goals. So about 97% of our permits are issued within that those timelines that are established in statute, which doesn't really help the 3%, right, where sometimes it's those more complicated permits or facilities that are still taking longer than any of us would like to see, including the Pollution Control Agency. That's something that Commissioner Bishop has already identified as something she'd like to continue to work on going forward. One of her three priorities is looking at both due diligence but also timeliness and looking for ways that we can continue to increase the percentage of our permit reissuances that meet those goals and really look at those 3% or 4% that don't and figure out why. What are the opportunities for enhancing the timeliness, working through process issues there? In the case of the True Shrimp facility, the company itself came in through the Minnesota Business First Stop project, and we worked with that company through that. The 21 months is the amount of time that Minnesota has been working with them on various questions and their development plans, things like that. They do have a research facility in Ballatin that we've toured and provided and shared information about. It really wasn't until September that the permit application came in. So we're actually still within the timeliness goals for that permit application. I don't say that, though, to take attention away from the fact that we still need to continue to get better, and that's something that we're very committed to, and something that Commissioner Bishop has definitely highlighted.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another issue that's been around here for quite some time is the wild rice sulfate standard. Mm-hmm. And we worked really, really hard last year in a bipartisan way to get that solved. Obviously, Governor Dayton and Commissioner Stein didn't see a path forward with what we presented. What do we have to look forward to in the next biennium?
Ms. Lanhammer.
Mr. Chair and members, I think right now folks are looking at the report of both the governor's task force on wild rice that finished their work in September, and then also there was a tribal task force that pulled together a report on wild rice as well. And I think my sense is that everyone's kind of digesting that and determining what might be the next steps around that to look for what are opportunities for coordination and collaboration. Everybody that I've ever talked about wild rice across the spectrum notes that they want to see that important resource protected. They also recognize that there are challenges with treatment technologies and things like that. So I think it's going to continue to be a robust discussion. Where it exactly goes, I think, you know, the legislature has as much of a say in that as anybody else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the latitude here. At one of our earlier meetings, we talked about the landfill up in the Andover area, and MPCA testified here that they didn't really have a position on that, and it hadn't been discussed yet with now Governor-elect Walz, or now Governor Walz. Is there any change on that, and what should we expect?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have been working with the new administration on their budget and bonding recommendations, and those are due out next week, and we'll have more information on that at that point. We have always testified in that is an important project. It is our number one score on our closed landfill risk site for 2018, and so it is an important project to us. What we laid out, though, was the schedule of just how things will move forward depending on when certain funding decisions are made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, there we are, as I understand, we are up against kind of a hard deadline on the bid. for the cleanup. If memory serves me correctly, it expires late February, early March. So I guess what I'm specifically asking here is, what is MPCA and Governor Walz doing to try to make sure, working with the legislature, that we meet that deadline and we get something done before that deadline takes this opportunity away from us?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we are continuing and ready to move forward. Right now we are in informational process, working with both bodies, providing information as they move forward their funding packages. Both bodies have had multiple hearings on this, and we've talked about the importance of it. Both bodies have also expressed an interest in getting this done and moving forward on it. And right now we are waiting to find out when the funding is available. Representative, as you mentioned, at the end of the month is the date that we have is building out our schedule to be able to do the work this fall. If we do not make that time, we do push it back. We'll have to change the schedule. And then with any schedule changes or spec changes that we have as a result of it, the contractor will be able to put forward if it's going to cost them more dollars or not. So we do share the urgency that the committees have expressed to move forward on this project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was at the AMC conference last night. I don't remember when it was. Two nights ago, I think it was, and talked to a number of county officials. A great deal of frustration from them out in rural Minnesota with regards to recycling. They're basically doing their recycling, but there's no market for the materials that they're collecting. And in some cases, they wind up just getting put into the landfill. And that costs extra money because they have to bring it into here, and then they got to take it over there. What are you doing working with the counties to try to make it easier and less expensive? Because what it's doing is it's adding another layer of cost to a mandate that's only partially funded.
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as Representative Fabian has mentioned, the change in the acceptance level of recyclable materials by China has greatly impacted the whole nation and where we send the materials. This has really hit home on the coasts where a lot of those materials were going to China as a result of more stringent contamination levels, more stringent than any of our systems in the U.S. can do. And on the East Coast, on the West Coast, they have been landfilling materials. We are unaware of any location in Minnesota landfilling materials. The prices have dropped on a lot of materials as a result, and in some cases we're seeing across the nation where a company, whether public or private, that was selling recyclable materials was getting dollars to sell their material out, and now it's needing to pay for it. Minnesota is different. We have a strong local markets, which we are continuing to work on. That's because of past investment made by the state here in companies that are all throughout the state, whether it's in Painesville, Worthington, Moorhead, St. Paul, Duluth, and those markets have really helped strengthen what we have here in Minnesota, so the crunch is not as hard. We are in constant communications with alders and counties on it. What we're doing, we have about two staff dedicated working with various industries and companies that are looking to make things out of recycled materials or adding value to it. An example is a company that's looking to take the plastics right now that come through a MRF, a materials recycling facility, that have high levels of contamination, adding value to it by cleaning it up and then chipping it so it's no longer a recyclable material. It gets beyond the barrier that China has put out before it because it's a value added, but it then can go into various production lines throughout the nation and the U.S. So one effort is working with those companies more in an incubation stage, not supplanting what Deed does. Deed and private banking can provide the big dollars, but we need to help those companies, whether it's information or small amounts of grants, to help them prove up their business plan to be able to make it to that point. That's one item that we're working on with multiple companies. A second is we've established a stakeholder group with the solid waste industries and counties to work together on some of these pieces of information. On what to do about markets. And that's to start it up. We've had a couple meetings of it. So that highlights a couple of the areas on market development. There are a couple other things we need to do, and one of them is education. And for over the last year, the agency has led with our local partners, local units of government, cities, counties, and also the industry on education and outreach. We're simplifying the message for recycling. Many of you are familiar with the term wish recycling, where folks throw things into the recycling container, which then becomes, as Representative Fabian mentioned, a problem for those who are doing it. And it creates heartburn or heartache for those companies. Our job is creating one unified message that any folks can share. We have received a grant as a result, and we're now piloting different ways to get that message out more than just some of the flyers people get at their homes once a year from companies, looking at social media and others to help get that message, to help those in the recycling business, whether it's a private or public facility collecting it, so that there's better product in, so that their value on the backside is even worth more as they try to sell it on open markets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When it comes to an EAW, there's a 30-day comment period. You probably know where I'm going to go with this, but there was a recent case in Ramsey County, I believe it was, with regards to a feedlot. Not sure of the details. I don't believe that the legislative intent of 30 days meant something beyond 30 days. Does MPCA have a position on what 30 days means in an EAW?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I guess what I would say to that is I know that there's been some legislation that's been introduced. We're taking a look at that legislation. I don't think we have a position on that legislation yet.
Okay. Thank you. And then does – oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you taken a position on the 404 assumption that's going around right now? We've worked really hard on that over the last, I don't know, how many years.
So, Mr. Chair and members, so the agency has been and continues to be supportive of the concept of 404 assumption, and there's details to work through and specifics that would need to be kind of worked through. We've been working cooperatively with the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Department of Natural Resources that have been looking at this over time, so we would welcome the opportunity to continue that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last thing, and then I'm sure other people want to ask questions too, but demo landfills continue to be a big struggle for a lot of rural counties. What can we expect in this biennium with regards to trying to address some of the concerns? Because if these landfills wind up closed, the debris is going to wind up someplace that we don't want it.
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, in regards to construction and demo landfills, C&D landfills, we are moving forward on multiple fronts. If we go back to the earlier slide about prevention management and cleanup, on the prevention side, in November and December, we held four meetings across the state in Crookston, Duluth, Mankato, and St. Paul, talking to various partners, not just the usual ones, the haulers that bring the materials there, the landfill owners and the like, but architects, reuse operations, construction companies, to talk about how do we keep things from going in the hole to start with. If we can manage it earlier, that will help us with the questions that we're seeing now and problems that we're seeing with C&D landfills. And so we're compiling all that information. They were half-day events where we had great participation and are collecting those comments, and we'll be having a report out back to everyone and looking at next steps. So that's one part of it. As we get closer to the management piece of it, we are continuing to work with landfills. We are now have three landfills with confirmed impacts on private drinking water wells. We anticipate as we continue to do that work, those number of landfills impacting wells will continue to increase. We are working with individual landfills on that, looking at what needs to be done in terms of further investigation, but also how do we stop the contamination from continuing to spread. And those are done right now on an individual landfills, looking at best management practices. You know, what is going into the landfills, how much the landfill is open, what type of cover is on it. And so those are conversations in the near term. And some of those things were, as such as the extent and magnitude investigations is on the very early stages. We've worked with and provided the local units of government that own these facilities and private companies a risk-based approach to tackle which landfills to look at. And this is a scoring system that's somewhat modeled off our closed landfill program, which looks at where our receptors, so that we don't just take in which landfill comes in for a permit. We really spend our limited amount of time that we have and resources on those which may have the greatest potential impact. Those are short-term, immediate-type pieces. The long-term efforts are we need to change the system and how we dispose of construction demo waste in Minnesota. We talked a little bit about the prevention part, but the management part and what is the disposal options is also something we need to look at. We kicked off a rulemaking this fall. We had a 90-day public comment period that ended at the end of December. We received one letter. We'll go through that. That's from AMC and the Solid Waste Administrators for comments. We are in the stages of a more detailed report that would be due. We're looking for to be due this spring, looking at each of the landfills and answering those questions of what are the contaminants that are coming out of them. What are the sources of that? Is it because of the landfill and the materials in it? Is it because of a redox situation that's occurring, which is when there's the carbon and the water in the landfills are interacting with natural occurring arsenic and manganese in these communities and liberalizing it from the soil and then creating plumes? Looking at that, or one of the things that the Association of Minnesota Counties have asked us to look at, are there other landfills in the vicinity, other sites that may be contributing to the issue that are incorrectly being contributed to C&D landfills? And so that's what we're doing, a more robust report on that, and that will be our goal is to have that completed this spring. As part of the rulemaking effort, we will be putting together an advisory committee. We are right now looking at ways for us to bring together stakeholders. We know we could have an advisory committee looking at just what are the design parameters for a landfill, but it doesn't deal with the larger questions or the system that we need to answer. It doesn't help answer, so what do we do with the old landfills and the problems that still exist there? If we need to have additional design requirements on landfills, or landfills move to a hub-and-spoke system where there's transfer stations where a landfill may not be, and then you have one landfill collecting from multiple locations, how is that financed? These are some underlying questions that need to be answered for us to have a successful rulemaking, even in terms of what do we build the specs for a landfill. And so that would be a stakeholder process. We are pulling together ideas internally, and then we'll be working with stakeholders to share those to get feedback on how we move forward on this. This will not be something that's measured in a matter of months to be solved. This is going to be a multi-year effort for us to be able to gain the support and the proper planning to have an approach that is holistically addresses all aspects of this issue more than just looking at sampling results that are coming off landfills.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, that just conversation raised one more question. So then in the meantime, if this is going to take that long, for C&D landfills that are operating under an existing permit that's actually expired, one of the counties told me the other day that that's what they're operating under, but now you've come in as an agency and said that, no, you can't have a 2-foot cover, you have to have a 5-foot cover. And if you're going through rulemaking and so forth, are you going to stop stop regulating and wait to see what the rulemaking and the new science shows rather than coming in with a mandate at this time?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the situation you're talking about is a short-term situation where we have around the boundaries of a landfill, we know contamination above health-based values, drinking water levels, is coming from a landfill. And so in that case, we do have to take corrective actions, and that is the current rules already for releases and things need to be done. And those really are take approach in two areas. One is looking further beyond the landfills to see if there's impacts, whether it's to surface waters or more importantly, our private drinking water or municipal wells. So that's one part that we are asking landfills to do, and we're looking to try to do that in a prioritized fashion, and that's something we're starting to do. The other item is when we do have that release, we do have to see what can we do to minimize it. Even if someone builds, there's a new set of regulations there on how landfills will be built tomorrow, we still have to deal with the problem that's there today. So the future cells may be built in a way that's protective. We still have to deal with the old ones. And that's what part of the conversation is. One of the most effective ways to solve how the contamination is coming from landfills is reducing the amount of water going through it. And right now, the amount of cover is one of the best ways to do that is to have an enhanced cover to create a barrier not to allow water to go into the landfills, pick up contaminants, and move them into groundwater, or to stop that redox situation. If we can keep the water out by enhanced covers or closing the way we, the open face of a landfill or looking at horizontal expansions versus vertical expansions, These are some of the best management practices that we are working with landfills when we do see problems on. We are not expecting a landfill to be able to do that overnight. That's going to take time, some of these things. The covers are expensive, but we need to start looking at those processes to be able to start that plan in motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a list. It's getting longer. And I'm going to just ask you to follow up with me later on, or if we do have time at the end, about dry cleaner cleanup and carpet recycling. But I'll go to Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Just two things. The clarification on the landfills that are contaminating drinking water right now. How many are there?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have three cases of a landfill where we have samples from private wells, where we have had over the health-based values from Department of Health, and a drinking water number has been, or a drinking water advisory has been issued. We have, stalling here to grab my numbers. Sorry, Chair and Representative. We have 88 online landfills. We know 67 of them have groundwater monitoring systems. These are pretty basic systems. One, upgradient to know what's coming into the landfill, and two, downgradient, so we know what's coming from the landfill. So we, if there's a lot of a different source that's contributing to it, we know what it is, or background. So of those, we know of at least 63% of the 67 landfills have contamination coming from their landfills above the Department of Health values. We know that at the where the wells are, we don't know how far it goes out. That's something we still need to work on.
Okay. I'm trying to get at this. Okay. Are these all unlined landfills? They're all unlined, not lined. Okay. And are they all demolition waste, or are all of some of them just plain solid waste?
Mr. Chair and committee members, all C&D waste. Municipal waste would be lined.
All right. So if that's the case, these landfill owners right now are liable for the contamination and liable to pay to help folks whose wells are contaminated. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, those who put waste into landfills and those that operate them would be liable for it. And in those three cases where we have private well impacts, the landfill owners have stepped up and are working to provide drinking water treatment systems for those wells.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Can I do one more question?
Oh, Representative Guinness.
Thank you. Just on back to the wild rice, and we talk about sulfur and wild rice. But sulfur, the same sulfur, can produce mercury. When you are looking at sulfur and raw rice, do you also look at the question of the methylization of mercury?
Mr. Chair and members, so both of those areas are active areas of research, not just work that the Pollution Control Agency is doing, but that other that research entities are looking at as well.
Representative Guinness.
But my question is a little more specific. When you are looking at the rice issue, are you also simultaneously looking at the mercury issue? Because one sulfur, two consequences. So they're not separate.
Mr. Chair and members, two things. First of all, when we're developing water quality standards, those are like chemical specific. So the standard is specific to sulfate or specific to mercury. When we're talking about mercury methylation, we do have water quality standards for mercury itself, for the elemental mercury. The way that the mercury becomes a form that is problematic is this process called mercury methylation, which is what Representative Wagenius is referring to, I believe. And one of the factors that plays into mercury methylation is sulfate. There are many other factors that play into that mercury methylation as well. So when I referenced that active area of research, one of the things that researchers are really trying to get a better handle on is which of those factors or combination of factors is controlling. It may not be the fact that sulfate is what's really driving additional mercury methylation. It could be another factor that's driving that. That's the sticky wicket in the research right now that is being investigated and trying to get a handle on.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to Enbridge's Line 3 replacement project, obviously the PUC has approved that project, and they've also laid out a very detailed route. So now we're essentially entering the actual more granular permitting process. So could you share with us what types of permits MPCA may be involved in, and at what point are you in working on that area?
Ms. Lattimer.
Mr. Chair and members, so there are four permits or certifications that the Pollution Control Agency is involved with regarding the Enbridge Line 3 permit or project. There is a 401 certification, which is a certification under the Federal Clean Water Act that has to do with dredge and fill, so works at, work in wetlands and water bodies. There's a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit that's needed for the hydrostatic testing of the pipeline. So once the pipe is put in place, it needs to be tested to make sure that it isn't leaking and is structurally sound, and that requires a permit because there's discharge of water then once it's basically pressure tested, and then that water gets discharged. There's a air permit that's associated with the existing transfer station in Clearwater, and then the fourth is a construction stormwater permit for any project that disturbs more than an acre of soil, kind of in total, that requires a construction stormwater permit under, again, the MPDES program. We've received applications for the air permit, the 401 certification, and the MPDES permit. That information is posted on our website, so if you're interested, you can go take a look at that. And we're right in the process of reviewing that information, seeing if we have the information we need going back and forth with the company with questions.
I've heard, Mr. Chair, follow up on my understanding is there's likely going to be some new pumping stations that don't exist on the old line. Do those fall into the air permit area the same as a much bigger Clearbrook facility?
Ms. Latimer.
Mr. Chair and members, the details of the project, I'm not well versed in, so I'd have to get back to you on that. My understanding is that the air permit is really focused on that Clearbrook Terminal, or Clearwater, so it'd be best if we responded in writing.
Thank you. I just would offer that the sooner we get this project done and get some grass over that pipeline corridor, probably the better it's going to be for public safety for all of us that live in Minnesota, because this is clearly going to be a testy project, and any delays, the longer we admire this issue and put the environment at risk, because we're using a 50-plus-year-old pipeline running at half capacity, we need to be reasonable, but we also need to move on this. This is not rocket science. We do miles and miles of pipeline every day in this country. So I just offer that if you need any help, let me know, because this is a time-sensitive situation from the environment standpoint, and dragging this out will continue to put people in my community at risk for all kinds of reasons.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're kind of covering the gamut today, but I don't know when I'll have another opportunity. And Representative Fabian brought up an issue relative to landfills, and I wanted to just quick check with the folks from MPC here. This is something that I'm hoping is on Representative Sabaginius's radar and others, because we were trying to recapture a lot of these things that would otherwise be going into landfills and divert them. And one of the big players in this in terms of food waste recycling is a company called Midwest Recycling Solutions. They're having a very difficult time, and thankfully Greta has been working very closely with us to try to figure out a solution, but I was hoping that if we could just take a minute and help the committee better understand how PFAS, which has come up today, is impacting food waste recycling and could very well create an even bigger issue as we're trying to divert these materials.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the question is about the water that comes in contact with the compost pads and the compost material. What we are finding that water that goes through it is called contact water. And what we are doing is have done some sampling on that. Facilities would like to land apply that. What we've been doing and sampling is seeing if there is PFAS in that water. And we have found it at high levels above health-based values. And as a result, we have not allowed anyone on a permanent basis to be able to land apply these materials because of the concerns that we see. And the concerns we see is what we see in landfills. We have six landfills in Minnesota, mixed municipal waste landfills with liners that capture leachate and then land apply it in situations and have monitoring wells around it. What we're starting to see is where that leachate is applied, where it is before it's applied with high levels above health-based values, then applied to the ground, we are seeing in our monitoring wells exceedances of health-based values in the groundwater. So we see a direct connection of how that is moving forward. As a result, we are starting to work with those six facilities and moving them out of the game of land applying these materials. This is as because of a direct result of seeing the similar thing play out in solid waste landfills, we are very hesitant to allow that practice to start with compost pads. We know this is a challenging situation. We are working with the specific company you talked about. We provided them with some materials recently on looking to see if there is a alternative way, possibly with pretreatment or limiting the amount of water that goes through these systems so that they're that goes through the compost material piles so we don't have this type of problem. I know that we are setting up meetings. We'll continue to meet with them. We provide them some information. I know we have upcoming meetings with staff on the issue. But this is a national issue dealing with how we are seeing PFAS in compost facilities and the contact water.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the concern that I have is this particular company is looking at an exit solution right now in Minnesota. And just to be clear, they're the second largest food waste recycler in the entire state of Minnesota. And we could very easily lose that resource in terms of the ability to recycle those materials. And so if the agency could help me better understand kind of some of the things we're working on to try to expedite that, because aside from land applying, it's just not economically viable to try and transport materials or to dilute, I guess, is part of the solution that has been proposed. It's really difficult. So I'm just trying to help the committee just put that on your radar, that we have absolutely got to try to find a solution to this or we're going to lose folks that are currently recycling hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons of food waste.
Representative McGinnis, to this point.
Yeah, so let's be precise about, I'm sympathetic to this, but where specifically is the PFAS is coming from? Is it the packaging? Is it because we are accepting packaging as part of composting? And if that's the case, maybe the solution is to say no packaging. But we need to know the source of the problem before we can say, nah, guys.
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we are in the midst of sampling yard waste and various types of food compost facilities, food waste facilities, and unfortunately we're finding the same results on both of them. So we do need to do additional research on what is the issue. Is it the pesticides used in yard clippings? Is it food packaging? We are trying to work upstream to find out what that is and see what we don't allow to go into the compost container so that we do that upsource reduction. At this point, we don't have the answer on the exact cause of it.
And Ms. Gauthier, there was something this morning that EPA proposed something on PFAS. Could you get that information to us so we can get out to the committee on how the federal government, what they're proposing on doing? And then Representative Gauthier.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I did bring that news release with me. The EPA did announce today that they have their first ever comprehensive nationwide PFAS action plan. So we are having our staff analyze that even as we speak, but we will get that information to you. And just to Representative Heintzman's question, we have been working with your constituent as recently as January 31st. We met with them and continue to work with them so that they can continue operating and talking about plans for this fall. So I'm happy to talk to you more online about what's going on, but just know that our staff have said that the constituent is now talking about how he can, what he can do this fall and how he can run his business and so forth, and we're working with him on those solutions. So hopefully maybe he's determined that he won't need to leave, but I don't know any more than that. But I'm happy to talk with you offline.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a quick comment to that point, and thank you. I appreciate that, Greta. So we are looking at a situation similar to what we're seeing with True Shrimp, where they may have options just immediately across the border. And that would create a solution for other states, but it leaves us in a bad situation. So I just want to say thank you and mm-hmm. appreciate anything you can do to try to help these folks, because they're doing, as far as I'm concerned, the Lord's work. They are literally diverting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons of material away from landfills. So if there is a solution, I hope we can find that quickly.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got some questions. First of all, I want to hit True Shrimp just a little bit. I think one of the things that you'd mentioned in the presentation earlier, Ms. Gauthier, was the fact that you folks provide a lot of technical assistance to different businesses when they're starting up and getting going. When True Shrimp was first coming in, what kind of assistance, what kind of dollars were involved when you were working with True Shrimp?
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Fisher. Thank you for the question. Yes, at the beginning part of the 21 months that we were working with True Shrimp, they asked for and we lent them the services of some of our engineers who provided engineering services for us. And I know you had asked me to determine the amount of money, and that was around $12,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from what I understand, do they pay back anything on this? Is this covered by fees, or is this covered out of the general fund?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fisher, they do not pay that back. I think my colleague can speak to where that money comes from. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, we would need to look specifically, but I believe it would be the environmental fund, so a combination of fees, solid waste tax. There's a number of elements that go into the environmental fund. So.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fisher, our CFO in the audience is nodding his head saying, yes, environmental fund.
Thank you. A little bit more on the True Shrimp. From what I understand, when we hear conductivity standards, what we're really talking about is the amount of salt that's in the water, correct?
Ms. Lahan.
Mr. Chair and members, essentially, yes. Conductivity is a measurement of the collect. It's basically a way to measure the collective amount of dissolved ions in the water. So that's salts and minerals that are dissolved in the water.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what happens if we have too much salt getting out in the water? What does it do to the landscape, say, if it's applied as irrigation, or what does it do to plant life, aquatic life, et cetera?
So, Mr. Chair and members, so the specific conductance standard that we're talking about particularly is a standard that was adopted to protect for irrigation use of water. So the intent of the standard is it's a measure of the amount of salts and minerals, and the concern is that, especially over time, too much salts or minerals that are in water that's being used to irrigate crops can be damaging to those crops because of the salt load that can affect the health of the crops over time.
Any other questions? Representative Fisher.
Thank you. And then I've got some, Mr. Chair, that go into a little different direction, okay. If I may. One of the questions I have is currently on the MPCA, when you've got permits that are out there, how many permits do you have out on people who've got permission to add pollutants into the environment?
Mr. Chair and members, we would need to get back to you with a specific count of the number of permits that we have. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, so about 18,000 permits overall, probably, and that's everything. So the construction permits are one chunk of those that are, I'm trying to remember, we can get that for you, but I'm thinking that maybe was, it depends on the economy, maybe several thousand of those a year, a couple thousand, three, four, five. Anyway, I don't know exactly. I know we did pull together some information recently on a certain type of air permit that was there, and that was about, I believe, was about 2,300.
And, Mr. Chair and members, just so you know, part of the reason why we're struggling is that a number of our permits are about preventing any kind of discharge. So, for example, some of our feedlot permits, they're zero discharge facilities in many cases, so it's about kind of containment. And then we have permits that are about limiting the amount of pollutants that can be discharged or emitted. And so there is an amount of discharge or emissions that are allowed. So we'd need to go back to the office and just do the quick breakdown of those 18,000 permits about how many of them are kind of zero discharge prevention kinds of permits and then how many are actually authorizing an emission or a discharge.
Does Representative Fisher want to move the minutes for the last meeting?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes from the last meeting.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are adopted. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions I have is particularly on air discharges, and where I'm kind of going is toward the water gremlin issue that is happening up in the area. Right now, from my understand, is when there's a problem, it's usually done by self-reporting. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members, so the issue around this facility, for those who haven't heard about it, it's in White Bear Township. It is a facility that makes posts for batteries, where basically the posts you clip your jumper cables onto. And the issue is emissions of TCE or trichloroethylene that are above the health limit. And so the fundamental foundation of the American air permitting as under the Clean Air Act is that basically you get the permit, look at the site and build the permit, the permittee gets the permit, and then they self-report periodically, like every 6 months, about how all of their pollution control mechanisms are working. And the way the Clean Air Act was set up was based on this self-reporting and giving that level of trust and partnership. But if there's violation, then the way the Clean Water Act is set up is that the penalties can be fairly severe because that trust would have been broken. So it's not uncommon for air permits, in fact, it's common for air permits to have self-reporting every 6 months about how their air pollution removal technology and equipment and systems and so forth is working.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the Water Gremlin site, while we had self-reporting occurring, right now it appears that it has been happening for quite a while. What is the current date that it goes back to that we are aware of that there is a violation that occurred when the base started first happening?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fisher, as far as we have been able to determine so far based on the records that the company has kept, it goes back to 2009.
Members, we have 1 minute left.
Fisher. What I'll do is I'll kind of wrap up here. I think there's something we might be able to come back to. But I am concerned that, I keep on hearing concerns that we're too hard on business, but here we've got a situation where TC, which is a cancer-causing chemical and one that can cause birth defects, was released in the environment for at least 10 years, and from my understanding, could be going back as far as 2002. Within the area, we have an elementary school. We've had a number of people that live in the area. We've probably got maybe 20,000 people that were exposed in there. And so I guess some of my concerns are is how we could allow something like this to happen and not have the protections for our people out there, particularly when we've got women who've grown up in the area, people that have been exposed for 17 years, and we've got kids in the same environment. So I do have some concerns. I want to kind of take a look at this because, to me, this seems like an issue that we should have somehow been able to figure out instead of waiting almost 19 years later.
Ms. Gothier.
Mr. Chairman, members, and Representative Fisher, this is an open investigation now, an enforcement investigation, and I really can't say much more about it than I already have.
Members, we're adjourned.